What more do you want from me?
I don't want peace. I want problems, always.
The hunt is on, and you're the prey.
Welcome, welcome, welcome to another edition of Office Hours with Professor Carl Tone Jones. I am Professor Carl Tone Jones, and I'm glad that you have decided to be here for another one of our Express It Philly Fridays. Philly Fridays, y'all, right here in FetLife Station at FetLifeStation.com. You can also catch us on all of your major streaming platforms. In your podcast platforms by going by one of our new channels, the True Stories Podcast Network. The True Stories Podcast Network, where, you know, and we're trying to get, you know, trying to steer more of our listeners in that direction because, you know, we're trying to build it up a little bit, you know, catch up with the other ones because, you know, as you know, we pop. And one of the things that, well, first and foremost, you already know, the doors are locked. You can't leave. You're already here. And you already know how I get down. Y'all know we don't play no games when it comes to, you know what I'm saying, you pulling up in here. Play no games. You know what I'm saying? You can't go. You just can't leave now. You know what I'm saying? So, shout out to everybody who is utilizing this holiday time to, you know, spend some time with their families. Because I don't get into the whole notion of the romanticism in regards to the holidays. And in fact, you know, I have a you know, there was a brother who put out a real good message. I put it down. I thought Chris Watt uploaded it. You know what? Hold tight. Because I think I got it up here somewhere. Where, you know, we're thinking about, like, what the holidays and the holiday seasons and sort of like the whole concept of the commercialization of it all. So, I want y'all to check this brother out real quick. Just take a listen, because he sort of sums up one part for which I'm thankful that I no longer have not engaged in many a decades. But hold tight, here you go.
What up, though? Garage Talk. So, a few days ago, I posted a video talking about how the way that we live, everybody is in this game, whether they like it or not. And somebody reached out to him. They said, hey, can you give me an example of one of the games that they're playing on us? And he's, you know, because there are many games. He said, but just give me one and tell me what you did to get out of it. Well, that was simple. The holiday game. So think about this shit. Most people don't really realize that we have a holiday damn near every month. You start off in the year in January. So you go from New Year's to Valentine's Day, the fucking sweetest day, Easter, Mother's Day, Father's Day, Memorial Day, 4th of July, back to school in August, Labor Day, Halloween, fucking Christmas, and all the other shit in between. So every month they keep putting shit in front of you because the goal, what they try to do is to distract you so they can extract from you. Because they're trying to extract your money, your time, your energy, your resources, because you got to remember, You're nothing more than a resource to them. You're no different than oil, gasoline, lights, utilities, etc. You just happen to be a human resource. So they're always using you to feed the system. So what did we do? We realized it was a game. So we said, you know what? Fuck that. We're just not going to play it at all. So we don't celebrate any holiday. What we do is we utilize that time to get the family together, eat, break bread, watch movies. And, you know, we do shit like that because I don't need a specific day for you to tell me I need to go and buy somebody something. I can do that anytime. I like the time of just spending time together with my family. And so we'll do that. And the big thing for me, you know what it does? It reduces my stress level for them too. We're not running around in these malls. Oh shit, I gotta get a present for this person. I gotta get a gift for this person and that. Oh shit, it's her birthday, I forgot. Oh, I need to go and get a Valentine's Day card and some flowers and oh shit, no more good cards left. Now I gotta be slick and try to write a hand note to make it seem like, no, none of that shit. Because, you know, it extracts so much from you and it's not even necessary. So that's a game. We just said, you know what? We're not gonna play. And even on your birthday, we don't buy gifts. We just say, hey, it's your birthday, let's have dinner. We can go out or we can cook. What do you want? Hey, we do whatever that person wants. They may say, I don't want to do shit, I'm tired. Cool, we move on. But we took control of that because we understood that part of the game that they were playing. And so we just chose not to play that one.
Yeah, see, that's more so understanding. Like that's like we say stepping out of the matrix, and like you said, it was a very simple and easy way of removing yourself from this concept of being involved in the commercialization of a lot of these days. You know, they call it the holidays because it's literally supposed to be the holy days, and they extracted holy, you know, holidays from holy, and it's typically a time for worship. But then you have to ask yourself, what are you worshiping? Those are questions for you personally to take a deeper dive. I'm not going to dive into that for you. I have my own understanding based on the various years of research and personal discovery from on my behalf. Those are questions you're going to have to ask. You know, like, what does a Christmas tree have to do with the birth of Christ? You know, you know, you have to ask questions. You know, you have to ask yourself those questions because if you don't know that, like, in terms of, Easter, right? What does the Easter rabbit, Easter bunny, Easter eggs have to do with the resurrection of Christ? And let's be clear, a lot of these holidays are based on some connection to a Judeo-Christian belief system, whether, you know, the religions of Abraham and the laws of Abraham. So these are the things, what they call them, the laws of Moses, right? But this is where a lot of this stuff comes from. So you have to ask yourself those questions, and a lot of you, especially when you understand the Nordic translation for what that is, for Christmas and the chimney, the man in the red and white suit, you'll be, you know. But that's neither here nor there for me. So that's why I say I take this time to spend time with my family. And, you know, especially I already told y'all in the previous episodes, you know, I had a tremendous loss of life in our family. So, you know, it's just time for us to sort of like regroup and reflect and also remember, you know. So take this time to love on each other. Make sure that when it comes to your family, that you exhaust, you know, all your love with them, at least enough so, you know, you never want it to be, you know, you're departing anybody when they depart. You never want it to be one of those things of sweet sorrow. I mean, not sweet sorrow, just sorrow, period. and regret. You wanted to be sweet sorrow. You know, you're sorrowful because they're no longer here, and you're going to miss them. You're going to miss their impact. You're going to miss their essence. You're going to miss just their physical presence in your life. Being able to reach out and touch them, talk to them, and, you know, just joyous expressions and good times. But then if you don't, you always feel like you got time, I got time, I got time. Eventually, you run out of time. And as I said at my aunt's memorial, when, you know, I had an opportunity to speak, so we don't know the time nor the hour for which we'll be called to leave this place, to leave this plane. So you better make do and do the best with the time we have, rather than putting time off. So, you know, use this time, y'all, to get down with your family. Spend time, share some love, energy with your family, okay? But, as y'all know, and as we get into the flow, you know, let me do the one. All right, this is we're transitioning now. Talking points, because, you know, we don't, you know, we don't, no, we say that we move forward. All right. So there's some notions and concepts that I want us to think about today. First of all, and fellas, this is for you to understand something. You know, we live in a time and era where there's consistently bad advice being given out in terms of how to deal with the world, ladies in particular. So I want y'all to peep this one, you know, this particular clip that I've put together. Well, I didn't put it together, but this particular clip. I want y'all to pay attention to this particular clip, because this one here hits home in a different way.
And don't be trying to let people trick y'all into thinking that being ran through is a bad thing.
Every day I get on this app, y'all remind me as to why independent thinking is so important for one's development.
And shout out to the self-checkout channel on IG and on YouTube. So go check the brother out, you know, give him a like, share, whatever. Check it out.
Few discretion's advised.
It's really not. If you ain't got at least 50 or 100 bodies, then you really not experienced. At least 25 to 50 bodies, you really not fucking experienced. You don't know what to do. And it's just, yeah, you got to at least have at least 50 to 100 bodies.
You ever see somebody and they look like what they've been through? You ever seen that before? Like, you could tell life has done a number on them. And you can visually see it. They don't have to tell you. You can just see them like, yo, I know you went through a lot, or you going through a lot. And, you know, I'm not one to get on here and talk about how the way people look, but when something is just that apparent, I can't ignore it. I just can't. Ma'am, you look like you got a lot of bodies in the worst way.
If you ain't got 100 to 200 bodies, then you really ain't putting in no work.
Shit.
And let me be clear about that. See, this is what I'm talking about. This is an older sister, right? And this is what I talk about all the time, that and we don't deal with the accountability that needs to come with this. This needs to be called out by the sisterhood. Black women need to call this stuff out, you know, instead of always trying to pacify it or look at another thing we can get away with and all this other, you know, that's not an adult way of dealing with these types of issues. We clearly have a situation in our community where the younger they are, more over-sexualized they are. In fact, the entire era, this is not even a generational thing. This era is over-sexualized. And in the process of over-sexualizing, it's a lot of irresponsible sexualization that's taking place and going on right now. And it's leading to a lot of broken homes. Because if you're telling somebody they need 50 to 100 bodies, that's not even saying that they're just having sex to 50 to 100 times. That's saying you multiply that by how many times they have been with each one of those people. Whether it was one time, two times, 10 times, maybe some of them were relationships. So, you know, this is just, so where is the moral response, moral obligation here? And then you're teaching this to young women when these older women who say this, they're the main ones complaining that nobody wants to deal with them. Nobody wants to date them. That they have, because they have hit the wall. And fellas, like I said, I'm not saying this because this is, I'm addressing what was just said. These are the instructions, the marching orders. And I find that, you know, how can you be a good ally? How can you be a person that you want these younger women to look up to when you're giving them advice like this? In other words, what you're saying is, I trashed my life and I think it should be okay for you to trash your life too. Not even talking about the soul ties and the many soul ties that have taken place. Not mentioning that every time a man, you know, has a man's semen enters a woman's body, that parts of his genetic code are planted in her brain. It affects part of her thinking. Not to mention the lack of attachment that develops because you've been out there and you've dealt with so many men, that eventually dealing with one man will lead to boredom. The average black marriage lasts less than 5 years. And the biggest reason for marriage breakups, they talk about money, it ain't money, it's infidelity. Or we've grown apart. No, you got bored with the sex and the sex was the draw for the marriage. Don't even matter if children are involved or not. And fellas, this is why you have to be smart about who you deal with. Just because it's easy doesn't mean it's free. And you, as black men, you're going to be caught in two different positions. One, you're going to be like,
what more do you want from me?
And she's going to be like,
this is it. I'm done. I'm done with life. And it's all Jermaine's fault. It's always Jermaine's fault. I'm done.
So you got to understand where that is. Now, here's I want y'all to hear what this comedian said, right? This white woman, she's a comedian. And I want y'all to hear what she said. I can't remember her name of her special. It was on Netflix. I do recall that. But I do remember this particular scene. So I'm glad somebody clipped it up. Check this out.
In an attempt to empower women, we've decided the best way to do that, to communicate with the masses, is to talk to women like they are fucking idiots. And we use a specific language. You've seen it. You've seen it in gift shops. You've seen it on thank you cards. You've seen it on empowerment bags. You've seen this pejorative, infantilized, I call it glitter speak. You've seen it splayed across RBG totes and Michelle Obama on a unicorn wine bottles. You've seen this language. Yes, sassy bitch, sassy AF, work queen, yes girl, twerk it mama, rosé all day, thick with three C's, working and twerking, not an entrepreneur, a she entrepreneur, not a boss bitch, cause it's different than a regular boss, like a boy. Boss bitch, yes, twerk queen mama, thick raccoon bitch, do it all day, bubblegum mama face. Yes queen, work bitch. Play all day, mama. They stole this language from black, gay, trans, drag queens and made it their own to sell you pencil bags.
Yo, did y'all hear what she just said? Let me go back a little bit so you can hear what she just said.
Pencil bags.
Hold on.
To sell you pencil bags.
Let me try to find it. Here
from
we go.
From black, gay, trans, drag queens and made it their own to sell you pencil bags.
In other words, a lot of the things you see these women doing today are modeled after black transvestites. They were formerly called transvestites. Now the term is transgender. From the 70s that were actually out there doing drag shows and all up in discos. All right. And they were the ones doing the drag, like all the stuff you hear now, all the different slang and verbiage. So you mean to tell me the best version of a woman is to model a man that was trying to be a woman? That doesn't make, but you can't say that to anybody anymore. And then if you're not attracted to that now as a man, you're gay. if you don't acquiesce to that as a black man, you know, specifically, you know, this is why I always say
the hunt is on and you're the prey.
Because what she just said is this is the whole concept around feminism and what this is what was sold. And for anybody to not understand what we're talking about here, there's been articles, not articles, interviews, books, whole lecture circuits around this whole conversation concerning what actually, how several power groups got together in the early 70s and decided that they were going to create a movement to create single, overly sexualized and sexually empowered women that were going to put career first, stay single longer so that they can build up certain parts of the economy. And they were going to use them. This is why you have so many women right now who are struggling to have children. This is why so many children right now are born with birth defects, such as autism, such as brain cancer, and all these other things, because they're waiting later in life to have children. And then you'll have to, no, you're not. As long as the woman's pregnant, as long as the woman is healthy. Listen, the results are the results. We could blame it, a lot of it, on the inoculations and the vaccinations, but there's multiple components to this. Those eggs are with the female from birth. They become defective, just like when, like a male sperm. Men can still have children at older age, but the sperm is defective. So you imagine older man and older woman deciding to have children. In addition to all the biological and chemical warfare that's going on with our food, our drinking water, the air we breathe, this is an unmitigated recipe for disaster. But I digress. All right. Because I want to really get into something. And this is what I want to get into in regards to what's coming up now. Right. Because there was a clip that I want to go over. And this is speaking to the 60s. Right. And it speaks to black men in their response to the racism in America, the civil rights movement at that particular time, and just the conditions in the black community. So I want y'all to pay attention, because there's a specific message that I want to focus on. So excuse me as I get ready to do some of my as I go into my narration. And as we once again transition to another part, you know. All right, check this out, family. The late 60s were a time when every American seemed angry at the nation, for the nation seemed fractured. I have to put this reel together to give a sense of how black Americans felt about the racial divide and the civil rights movement. Warning, these statements are intense.
We're not interested in interracial housing. We don't want your neighborhood. We want ours to be just as good. See, we don't want a store in your neighborhood. We don't want you coming in our neighborhood and open up stores and exploiting us and then go home and throw a bomb if we move next door out in the suburbs. We don't want your schools, but we want our schools to be the highest and the best possible for our black progeny. See, what people don't understand, we are saying, and we're not asking. You see, the die is cast, as I said. We're not asking. We're saying this is the way it's going to be.
The young lady from Winnetka has stated that she saw during the marches which she participated in people who were full of fear and hatred. Mr. Lucas has said that the American Negro is either going to be free or he's going to be dead.
Now, you get this straight. You can kill all the black folks you want to, baby, but you will not kill the freedom of black folks. It's coming. We're going to get it. We fought in every one of your damn lousy wars, baby, and you give us nothing. Now, the war is going to be here. Because we're going to be free. Now, you kill all you want to, but we kill too.
I don't agree with the moderator nor Reverend Robinson that we want some kind of agreement. We want agreement by which we can live
or die. You choose. If you won't listen to me when I make an appeal for the Negroes because you have no concern for the Negroes, listen to me when I make an appeal for America. You claim you love America. Well, we love America. But you are driving us back and you are making a Samson out of us, and we are going to pull down the pillar. Should you try to pretend that I'm crazy because I want America to be saved? And then you think we have no right to ask for something? Is it too much to ask you to grant us human dignity? Should we be put down and shot to death for this request? If so, you can aim your guns. What the hell do you think we care about dying if you're going to deny us the right to live?
You know, this revolution is filled with so many ironies, really. First, you tell us that it is manly to keep your word. All right? If you are a man, you keep your word. And now all that the black people in this country are demanding, and even the black people in the whole world are demanding, is that you keep your word. You told us we were free. Well, then show us that we're free. You told us that there is justice, equality for all in this country. Well, then stick to your word and let us see the justice and equality for all. Or else admit to us that you're not a man, you're a worm, you're afraid of us, you're afraid to give us equal stand. You're afraid that if you give us equal ground that we will match you and we will override you. And if that's what you're afraid of us, then tell us that just what you're afraid of. But don't keep hiding it from us and holding this up to us, and every time we ask you for something, you give us a little bit of something, and it's all tokenism. We don't want tokenism. And there are most black men in this world that don't want charity. And yet still every time we ask you for something, you give us a little piece, a little piece. You're playing games with us. We're not children. We're big men. I've seen my father have to put up with all kinds of stuff. He was a big man. He raised a family. He went down south and he had to go around to the back door with his wife. We're not asking for anything. We're not asking for any favors. All we want is what's ours. Now, there are many black veterans who are coming back, and they're mad. They're angry. Do you think that they're going to sit down through this? Our fathers didn't have the knowledge that we have. They sat through it. But there are other black youth that are not going to sit through it. We know about Che. We know about Fanon. We've read the books of our revolution. We've listened to Mao and his quotations. We know where we stand.
And I want y'all to understand something, what he's just saying, because there was a direct and not so subtle response to this that many people don't understand to this day. All right. This brother is talking about coming back from World War II, the brothers that came back from the war in Korea, the Korean War, an American Korea War. And also, you know, these brothers was also coming back home from the Vietnam War. All right. And I want y'all to understand what they're talking about. See, the first couple brothers that spoke specifically to not just black men being revolutionaries, but they also spoke to the fact that these brothers are warriors. These brothers actually participated in every American war on this continent. But every time black men participated in these wars, they became empowered. They became empowered. And when black men became empowered, they became an immediate threat to the current dominant power. It was, and when you understand, when you become a threat, there's typically a reaction or a response. When the power base sees that there is, you know, an adversary rising against it, the power base does something. I'm going to get into that in a few minutes, but I want to let these brothers, you know, and it's not just brothers speaking, but I want y'all to pay attention to the different tones and tonalities at which these brothers are speaking from. because we're going to dive into that too. So remember, we're going to talk about the tonality of these brothers and what they're saying, and we're going to talk about the American response to what was said.
We're not going to sit for it. We're asking, and if we ask and we don't get, we're prepared to stand up and take it. If I ask a man, I tell a man I am hungry. I tell him I am cold. And I ask him to do something about my condition. And this man holds a loaf of bread right in front of me so I can see it, and I keep asking him, I'm begging him, to please give me a slice of the loaf of bread. I am hungry. Then it is known by every psychologist that the next step in the progression is I am going to knock him upside the head and take the bread from him. I'm not going to starve to death.
And what he's talking about is power. He's talking about power. He's talking about promises that were allegedly made to black people here in America post-Jim Crow, post-slavery, post-Civil War. That's the loaf of bread. That's the power. Not even asking for all the power, just a piece of the power. But you also heard what his response would be, the tonality. Eventually, we're going to take our power.
All we're asking, no one wants to see blood. No one likes the smell of blood. No one wants war. Anyone who's been in war doesn't want war. Everyone knows what it is to see the inside of a man's gut hanging out and see your friends die, see relatives die. No one wants to regress back to the state of mind where you have to think it's all for the cause, therefore my mother has to die, my wife has to die, my brothers and sisters have to die. No one wants that. But you're pushing us to it. You're leaving us no choice. We're asking, we're begging. The students up at Columbia, they ask. The brothers down south ask. The brothers in Latin America, the brothers in Africa, they're all asking.
And that's another thing, too, about the conditioning. See, this is the part of the cognitive dissonance that still resided in black Americans. And he's not even talking about black. He's talking, what he's responding to is the global response to racism, white supremacy. And see, this is where a lot of differences with the black, and you know, you can even say the Pan-African experience, right? Other people didn't ask. Other people, it came with demands. See, this was so they still got the warrior talk, but he's speaking to the demands, right? Like so he has demands, but he's phrasing them as requests, questions, you know. And that's part of the cognitive dissonance, because he's basically telling them, after a while, we're no longer going to ask, we're going to take it. Whereas in other groups, they didn't give any warnings. They were more discreet with theirs. But this is the, you know, dealing with the nanny state that black people were birthed in, black Americans in particular, the colonization of black people and other black people across the world. This is the part of the response to the colonialization that took place. This is sort of the emotional response to it.
All they're doing is asking. Our fathers asked. Our grandfathers asked. The presidents of our universities, our colleges had to go to your back doors to beg that their children be given just enough money so that they could be taught something to live off. And yet still, they ask and ask and ask, and you refuse to give them anything. Now, we're just about out of patience. We're not going to ask anymore. The news media says that it's only the young that are militant, only the young that want this and want that. Okay, but we're 40% of the black population now. Or we were a year ago, and still yet we're climbing. Before long, we'll be 50%, 55%, and then we'll have the command. We're not going to take it. We're not going to take sitting in rotten parks and in places that just aren't fit for living. We're not going to take it. There's a limit to a man's patience, and everyone knows that God, Christ, heaven, everyone knows that what we're asking is not $1 million. All we're asking for is humanity. We're asking to be allowed to live like human beings. And God.
And this is why when Malcolm said he was going to take his case against America to the United Nations, he wasn't looking for civil rights. He was actually charging them with human rights violations. This is one of the biggest reasons why they saw fit to expedite the process of removing Malcolm X. All right. So just keep pay attention now, because this was the environment at this particular time. Right. And as you heard the young brother speak, right. Well, he's at this particular time, he was a young brother. As you heard him speak, he was speaking about the transition of generations. All right. The older generation took it. The younger generation, they were the ones that burnt down the cities. They were the ones, the riots of the late 60s, 1967, 68, and 1969. They were the ones who were burning down these cities. You had Chicago, Baltimore, Philly, Los Angeles, the Watts riots, right? You had all these different particular places in the country that were on fire at this particular time, because most black people in the city, we don't own none of this shit. We're not benefiting from any of it. So this was the this was the response, all right? As Martin Luther King said, riots are when you hear the voices of the unheard, or the voices of those who feel powerless. They result to riots, right? I'm paraphrasing, but you get the drift.
God, you tell us that this is too much to ask. You're sick. You're definitely sick. How can you tell me that it's too much to ask to be a human being?
Why am I mad? You know, white people ask me, why am I so angry? And, you know, I don't have any answer for him, because it'd be ridiculous for me to answer him, because he couldn't understand anyway, obviously, because he asked me the question.
The 400 years that I've existed there, 3 years, you know, 3 generations within my own family, why don't you know what I'm like? What is it so new in 1968, or, you know, in the 60s, that you've got to learn? Because my grandfather was born, you know, he's 90. My mother was ready for integration. You know, she's middle class Negro. Now, all of a sudden, you come to me and you say, you know, communicate with me. Hell, I've been here all the time.
And we've been
where were you?
Communicate.
Now, what do I have to say to you?
Now, I want you to understand, too. Now, this is a young sister talking, and this is, like she said, 1968. Notice what she's asking for, right? She's talking about integration. She's talking about, why don't white people listen to her? Why don't you know me? In other words, she's appealing to their better nature, allegedly, right? To their alleged better nature. But the whole concept behind her response is like the tonality is different. And that's where you start to see, right? Because after this point, you start to see the feminist movement kick in. Remember the comedian that you just heard from? Speaking about the whole feminist movement, that's what took over the whole black nationalism, the Pan-African movement, the Back to Africa movement, all the black power movements, all those different movements. This is the energy that countered that masculine energy that you saw previously, that you heard previously, when the brothers was like, we're just going to take it. All right. We're not asking for integration. We just want what's ours. All right. We don't want to live on the block with you. As the brother said earlier, we just want our neighborhoods to look nice. We want to have access to clean parks. We want to have access to, you know, livable areas, not downtrodden areas, not areas that were redlined into poverty. We wanted that. Right. That's the brothers, in other words, are saying, listen, as a man, I'm addressing you as a man. You want to respond to me like that, like a man. We're not asking to be part of you or live or inclusion. We just want what's ours.
Advanced nation in the world. It has to be resolved. It has to be resolved, because I want my children to have an answer. If not me, I personally prefer that I have an answer. You know, I don't have, you know, I like to think I don't have my lifetime to waste on this.
Most people say, if you don't like it here, get out. That's for spineless people. Spineless bastards who don't want to fight for what they believe in. Well, I'm staying here because I was born here, and I am going to fight for my freedom. And before I have kids, I am going to make sure that this damn United States deserves the existence of my kids, because I will not rest until every Sunday school is safe for my kids, so that they won't get killed or beaten up like those kids down in Mississippi.
And he's referring to when the church, the 19th Street Baptist Church that was bombed. When you talk about the four little girls, that's what he was talking to. That's what he was specifically talking about. And so I just, you know, just making sure y'all can draw the parallels, because, you know, the history, you have to understand the historiography. That's the climate in which he's talking about right now.
In 1966, that is going to stop, or else I'll be dead. Either one, you white folks have either one of two choices. Give me my damn freedom or kill me. Because I am tired of sitting by being an Uncle Tom or a house Negro like Booth and Wilkins. Those two guys are not Negroes. They're white people with man tan. That's all. They don't speak for us. They have found their way into the white man's house, the white man's establishment, and they are not about to make waves. But I am, because I am not going to take seeing my kids walking to a newly integrated school and getting their heads whipped in by grown men. Because if that happens to my kids, there are going to be a lot of damn dead white folks, and I mean a lot, because I am not going to take this junk no more.
And you're, this brother had a speech impediment, but he got it together when he said what he needed to say. All right, so I just want to peep gang, peep the tonality now. All right.
The days of step and fetch it are dead. The days of the black face, big wide-eyed, gin-drinking black man are dead. Now we have what is called black consciousness.
But why is it that black people don't own the land where they live? White people own that land. We've never been taught property values. You see, we've never been taught property values. I don't own Harlem, for example. Black people don't own Harlem. So who gives a damn whether Harlem burned down or not? How are you going to tell me to love this property that exploits me every day when the average black man in Harlem works the first Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday for a landlord? And on Thursday, he's working for Con Edison. And on Friday, he works for himself. And he's got the day off on Saturday, and he buys him a drink of liquor. And the minute he gets drunk, then a white policeman arrests him, takes him in a white court, and takes his money for two other weeks. And he goes in debts for the rest. And he goes to a white landlord, goes to a white pawn shop, or else he goes to another white loan shark to keep living on credit to pay off the white man. And he's paying taxes and profits and vacation pay for white people. So the average black man ain't got nothing to lose by anything that he does. And this is what the white man better understand. Nothing from nothing leaves nothing. Simple. As ABC. Or as 1, 2, 3, any way you go. There's no need asking me why these black people burning down these buildings out here. Hell, they got a positive answer. And people are not as dumb as people would think. With all the brilliant white psychiatrists and psychologists, you've been able to find a damn path to the moon, but you ain't been able to find one goddamn path 1 mile up the street. Maybe you better take time with just all this unique ability to find all these scientific discoveries that you've got to learn how to find your way into men's hearts and the men's mind.
Let me put it to you this way. We are proud of being black and of our black heritage.
Oh, and remember, like the previous brother, before this brother, remember what I said about when black people started burning shit down? They knew that they didn't earn those properties. They didn't own those buildings, and they were being exploited. Okay, I'm just trying to, you know, provide a frame of reference.
But white America does not accept the concept that this is a multiracial society. It has never accepted the fact that there are black people, brown people, yellow people here alongside them. They've always looked upon America as being white. And hence, all of its propaganda is directed at us to convince us that somehow or the other we must become white before they will accept us.
The problem is the standard for discussion is set by the whites. And a lot of Negroes now don't want to accept that standard anymore. They say we're going to have our own standard. I think that the hookup comes if you can develop a whole new standard where whites and Negroes can have a dialogue. Not either one of those are acceptable anymore. I mean, whites aren't going to accept Negro standards, and Negroes no longer want to be white. So that the clear thing is to develop a whole new standard, and then everybody move toward that so there can be some kind of dialogue.
You know, from a child up, at first I wanted to be white, you know, because my family was 20 of us, 6 girls and 14 boys. We would make 15, 60 bales of cotton, gather all that cotton, and we wouldn't have food in the wintertime. So I figured then the white people must be right. But as I got older, I said, no, it's something wrong. And if I ever get a chance, I'm gonna do something about it. I'm thinking about in terms of a better and a greater world for all people. And we can't do that by me in one corner doing what I can do to hurt you and you in the other corner doing the same thing against me.
So you go ahead and vote. So what?
So, you know, I think it's Fannie Lou Hamer. And see, even she, right? Even she, who's considered a revolutionary, right? For at that particular time, even she was not. You know, she was speaking from the perspective of getting brothers, you know, this whole equality sort of like conversation. And she was considered a strong revolutionary at that particular time. You see the tone. And, you know, not all the brothers, I will say, had the warrior spirit as the others, because The brothers that are talking about creating a dialogue, they don't have the same energy, right? They don't have the same passion as or the same purpose as the brothers that are talking about when we're not going to take this shit anymore. All right, is there's difference here? There's a difference. I'm gonna let this play a little longer, and then you know we're gonna get into the nooks and crannies.
So you vote for a senator, and the senator's constituency is either lobbyists or lobbyists who represent big business or lobbyists who represent himself. So what? So you can vote.
There's been a lot of talk and a lot of shuffling of papers, but in terms of the plight of the black man in this country, there's been no perceptible change, primarily because the white man has no reason to. He enjoys the highest standard of living. His government enjoys dominance in world affairs. Why should he turn to me now and say, I want to share part of my good fortune with you? He has no reason to.
I think there's going to be violence.
And that's what it is. Power. Power doesn't give itself up reluctantly. You have to take power. And that's what the conclusion that a lot of these brothers have come to at this particular time. And this is what I'm talking about. The intestinal fortitude of black men has started to shine, started to rise at this particular point. All right. Remember, there's another part to this, though, because we talked about the tonality, and we're going to soon talk about America's response to it.
See, because there already has been. I mean, when people try to free themselves, they kill Negroes in the South all the time. The Negro man has been emasculated and destroyed by the fact that every time he stood up, he got just snuffed out right there. So I don't think there's any question but that there's going to be violence and brutality. But my attitude is that the brutality and the violence shouldn't become the reason that you want to be free. But that's a very personal thing, the freedom is. See, the question isn't what is freedom to me, it's what price freedom. Because sometimes the price that you pay for freedom is the very thing that makes you a slave again. That's what I think happened in Russia in 1917. But I know that there's going to be violence. I mean, I think it gets blurred, especially the individual, if I face you violently. See, who knows where that violence began? See, I mean, I might, if I face you with a gun and you got, I got orders to kill you and you got orders to kill me, then we can't really deal with each other. Well, you're a target and I'm a target. So you can't really talk about that. But you have to, you can talk about the larger thing, the much more universal thing. The reason that you're there, see, is really not to kill, but to free.
And it's amazing how he spoke about the emasculation of black men and then exuded what emasculation looks like. When, you know, he's sort of like speaking from a perspective that he's going to back down from the confrontation. You know, it's very interesting.
Let us take a look at Harlem, 1964, when approximately 20 Molotov cocktails were exploded in Harlem. And in 1965, in August, in Watts, Los Angeles, 2,000 Molotov cocktails were exploded. I think that we are developing a more sophistication, and I think in the next uprising, and I suspect it will probably come through either in Washington, D.C. or in another unnamed city, where you're going to find 5,000 Molotov cocktails used.
On my way to Washington.
All right, and, you know, then you know, brother breaks out in song and he speaks. This is, and it actually was a revolutionary song, but I really want to get into why, you know, this topic is pertinent and why it's important that we understand as black men that this was sort of like the time when black men were fed up. And you saw like this, this was sort of like the precursor to the black power movement, right? This was the precursor. This is the early stage. This is when the embers were burning. It didn't catch fire yet. And so remember what I said about the American response to this. The white American response to this. And I'm talking about, when I say white American, I'm talking about some white supremacist controlled systemic response to this. Lessons learned from all the preceding wars. You started having from the civil rights, not civil rights, but the Civil War, right? When blacks in the South were given guns as they were needed to help the Union win the war. Make no mistake about it, the Union would have lost that war if it wasn't for the free blacks that walked off those plantations and picked up guns and put on that blue uniform, all right? And so when those brothers got the taste of actually killing white men, seeing white blood at their own hands, you couldn't tell those brothers what to do. Those brothers migrated south. And that was already like the largest underground railroad as was. I mean, we talk a lot about Harriet Tubman, and she deserves all the credit she got. All right. General Tubman was tremendous in terms of her liberation, you know, push and the things she did to help further establish the Underground Railroad. She didn't create it, but, you know, and shout out to Charles Till here in Philadelphia, who was also key and a key part of the Underground Railroad. So in addition to that, South had Underground Railroads, but they weren't so underground. It was literally raiding plantations there in the South. All right, you really need to learn about the Gullah Wars from about 1811 to the late 1840s. That was sort of the precursor that led to the Civil War, okay? But they learned. They learned from that Gullah War. So in 1857, when you had the Dred Scott decision that made it to the Supreme Court, Dred Scott case. And it's basically Dred Scott versus Sanford, right? And the ruling was that if he was property, that he was to remain a slave. And just because they had migrated into a freed state didn't mean that he was a free slave, that he was no longer a slave. And it's amazing because, and I believe it was Ferguson, Missouri. I might want to look into that. But what happened after that was Then you had one of the ruling the presiding Supreme Court justices make a declarative statement. Chief Justice Roger Taney, right? And there's a street in Philadelphia named after him. I think they removed his name from the street because after a strong push. But he's basically stated that he's the one that said this, the quote that there's no the white man, the black man in America, the African slave or the anybody born of an African has no rights that a white man is duty bound to respect in this country. He's the one who said that statement. And he also made a presumption. He also spoke on the Missouri Compromise. And for those of you who don't know, the Missouri Compromise was put in place because they started expanding westward, you know, eminent domain and, you know, white folks. They started expanding westward and killing off all the natives, you know, and especially when they found that gold in the Black Hills, right? And right, ironically, where Mount Rushmore is, okay? So they, what they said was that at the time, they wanted to make sure that the expansion had both free labor states and slave labor states so they can maintain balance in Congress. But he ruled that a state should be able to you know, create its own policy in regards to that. In other words, if a state wanted to become a slave state, then there should not be a requisite balance to that equation, which means that the presumption is that you know, there should be no embargo on whether or not they can become slave states. See, that's one of the things they learned. Don't create any more places where these Negroes can feel free. Because once they get a taste of freedom, it's their power. They're going to be reluctant to give it up. And you go all the way to World War II. What happened in the South during World War II? You had the establishment, because at that time, it was toward the end of Jim Crow, like the midway point of Jim Crow, the Jim Crow era. It's post-Reconstruction, the separate but equal ruling in 1896, I believe. That was the establishment of Jim Crow, with black terrorism, with terrorism on black people throughout the South. And you had the Deacons for Self-Defense. These were all former war veterans who would have engaged in shootouts, and they would become the security. They were actually security for Martin Luther King when he would go to different places in the South. They were actually making sure, because it was also all kinds of death threats about whether the Klan was going to come to, you know, to hang him, whether the corrupt police departments, which are also, you know, part of white supremacist outfits and white extremist outfits. So they would get into shootouts with the different sheriff offices. They would get into the shootouts with the cops. They would get into shootouts with the Klan down there. But they were the protective guard. They actually were the inspiration, one of the inspirations for the Black Panther Party. So, and that was in the late 1840s, early 1850s, well, the 1850s, I'm sorry, 1855. That was them. They were the inspiration for the Black Panther Party. And we can go on and on. But the Vietnam War was very special because they noticed that every time black people came back from war, that black men became more empowered and black men became less tolerant to a lot of the racism. So they sabotaged those soldiers that came back from World War II, from the Vietnam War. The Vietnam War was the first time soldiers were not rewarded but punished for being a part of the war. Yeah, I know a lot of y'all gonna say, well, hey, wait a minute, Professor. It was white folk that also, you know, faced torment, that was sprayed with Agent Orange and all those different biological weapons and chemical weapons, and they came back and they had disabilities and so forth, and you see them homeless to this day. Yes, 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 indeed. What you have to understand about racism, white supremacy, right, is, and this is what, you know, our great, great fallen leader, spokesperson and thought leader, Neely Fuller stated. If you don't understand what racism, white supremacy is, what it does and how it operates. Everything else you'll learn will only serve to confuse you. They will make white folk, particularly poor white folk, collateral damage in order to block or subterfuge another particular group's movement forward. They play like pieces on the chessboard. They move these different pieces around. It doesn't matter to them. And that's why, you know, you had to, because that, you got to pay attention to all the different things that happened at that point. You got to pay attention. In that particular time in history, as those brothers were pulled into that war, what the rich white folks do? They fled to Canada. They had draft dodging parties. Rich white folk, parents bought them out of the war. They never had to go to war. A lot of your presidents were draft dodgers. G.W. Bush was a draft dodger. All right? So they didn't have to. So they didn't care about the white folk that came back. And when they did that, they debilitated. You also had the war on drugs, where they were also using the Vietnam War as cargo to from the Golden Triangle over in Asia to bring heroin here to America and to destabilize the black community. You had lines around the block out in the open, drug dens that the police were ordered to allow to operate. Yet governments. Then you go to South America. And don't forget the head of the CIA at that particular time, George Herbert Walker Bush. I know I'm not fucking y'all up today. Y'all don't even know. Right? And so who had connections into South America, Central America, and all the different wars they were financing? And that's when he started coming up with, see, heroin blocked the progress of the black community. Crack cocaine was the destabilization force. And Nixon, who was the president in the early 70s, one of the presidents that was co-conspirator in terms of the Vietnam War, was later taken down because of, what was it called? The scandal in which they were breaking into government offices. Damn it, I can't remember the name right now. But it was a scandal when he was breaking in. He had hired people, hitmen, to break into government offices and to get different files that the FBI had hidden away. All right? They also said the war on drugs is really the war on black people. And then you start seeing in the mid-80s, in the early 80s, the crack cocaine epidemic overtake the black community. Destabilize it. At that particular time, you also had a push in black feminism. So which now you had the same ideologies that you heard before, the emasculated ideologies that you heard before that lacked the intestinal fortitude to fight, that wanted to more so compromise with the different racial disparities that was going on in this country. That's when you saw the takeover. When black men had their balls, the government of America decided to put war against us. The corporate sponsorship of the government of America and white supremacy decided to war on black people, black men in particular. And we have never recovered. Now, they have changed up the whole side. And then the elite black folk, so-called elite black folk who got the college, they got white collar jobs. They thought they became part of the black, this whole middle class, this whole middle class thing. And they were only middle class in title only, not in salary. Not to mention the removal of factories when black people were making headway, the car factories, all the different factories in the black community, they were all taken out. And then the drug economy was what replaced it. The gang economy is what replaced it. You have to truly understand how all these things are connected. And black men, you have always been the bullseye. You have always been in the crosshairs. But you have to recognize that, and you can't consistently look at these situations and say, that's not my fight. Somebody's bringing the fight to you. If somebody knocked on your door and said, if you want to come outside, you got to fight me to get off your steps. Are you going to just stay in the house? This is that call back then and this call now. It's for black men to hold their nuts. You have to understand your place. It's not at the feet of anybody. As I often said,
the hunt is on. And you're the prey.
So, Peep Game family, there'll be more to talk about in future episodes. But I'm actually over time right now. So I'm going to cut this one short. Once again, thank you all for riding with your brother on this Philly Friday. You know, episode of Office Hours with Professor Carl Tone Jones. As I tell you all, love on your families. You know, be safe out there. Because as I always say, if you want peace, you better be willing to wage war for that. And with that, my family and friends, I wish you all a farewell. Talk to you soon. Peace and blessings.